Hello, if you've been listening to our past two episodes, we've talked about violence against women, and we will be talking about violence against women again today, as well as domestic violence. So please listen cautiously, take care of yourself, and if you or someone you know needs help, there is a National Domestic Violence Hotline available 24/7 at 1-800-799-7233.
We just can't get enough of it.
Violence against women.
Clearly.
Clearly.
I'm glad you're here. I'm going to get right into the message. I'm going to tell it like it is, as they say. I heard a hallelujah. Do you think I don't know what the hell is going on? And a lot of strange places. Where in the hell have you been? Hellfire. All right. Okay. There's something else, too.
Hello. Welcome to the Satire Fire, your favorite podcast that's apparently about violence against women recently, and I'm so sorry that we are here again, but I'm not sorry. I think it's important to talk about, but we've had a depressing few episodes, and we're here for another depressing episode talking about the book Her Body and Other Parties by Carmen Maria Machado. So in the first part of this series, we discussed one of the short stories in this book, The Husband Stitch, and then in part two, we discuss two more stories, Real Women Have Bodies and Eight Bites. And today we are going to discuss two more stories in this book. There are a few stories that we're not going to discuss because this is a book of short stories and we just don't have enough time to discuss them all. And we don't want to overload you with just too many really depressing episodes about being a woman. So today we're discussing Mothers and Difficult at Parties, which deal with two different topics, but both deal with recovering from trauma, and that is why I chose them. And so that's what we're going to be doing today. But before we do that, Samuel, how are you? Anything you wanted to chat about?
And my name's Samuel.
Oh no! Also, Samuel is on this podcast. Sorry, it's just that he's a man, so.
Would you like to tell people what your name is, too?
I did not do this correctly. My name's Sydney.
It was a great... I didn't want to interrupt you because it was going really well, but yeah, you're Sydney and I'm Samuel, and I have been reading some other things lately that I would love to talk about. I am going to break the mold a little bit because I think this is the first time that I'm going to talk about a nonfiction book as an intro book. Typically, I'm more of a fiction reader. I've been reading... I read nonfiction occasionally, but I've not yet read one that I wanted to talk about, but this one is pretty interesting. It's called Young Men and Fire, and it's by Norman McLean. And if you have ever worked firefighting or been near somebody who worked firefighting or worked for the National Forest Service, you will have heard about this book. This is like, wildland firefighters love this book, man. And it's understandable. It is telling the story of the early days of smoke jumping as a profession. So if you're not familiar, smoke jumpers are a type of wildland firefighter who specifically, in order to get to remote fires that would be very difficult to access by land, are instead jumping out of helicopters or airplanes with parachutes and then fighting the fire on the ground after having jumped out of said airplane. So it's a very hardcore profession, and it used to be significantly more so because there was a less in the way of safety that protected people who were doing this job, like not as good of equipment, people were not as well trained. And also one of the issues, and this is kind of what this book deals with, is we had not yet figured out what situations were safe to use smoke jumpers and what situations were not safe to use a smoke jumper. Because what the story revolves around is one specific wildfire where it started really small. Smoke jumpers were sent out. They jumped in. And about 6 hours after they jumped out of the airplane, all but two of them were dead. Because they had been sent in to fight a fire that was on a tipping point of becoming extremely large, extremely quickly. And by the time that they recognized those conditions, only two of them were able to get away before the fire caught up with the entire group and killed everybody else. And so this book is kind of looking at the story of what happened. Why did certain people die and certain people didn't? Why did certain people make decisions that other people didn't? It really does a deep dive into it. And I should make a really quick correction. I said two. It's for sure not two. It's three. There's three of them that survived because I forgot that like their captain also survived. But this event was really influential because it made us start to question, well, what training should a smoke jumper have before they're sent out on a fire? They should obviously be better equipped to recognize the signs of when a fire might suddenly become significantly larger. But also, this was a fire that was burning in the middle of nowhere with nothing nearby that was going to be damaged as far as like towns or houses or anything like that. And so it made us start asking the question of like, well, what if we just didn't send them? Because nothing was really at risk. We didn't have to put these people in danger in order to save anything. So why did we really use them? And it's a really interesting book. I will say the author has a penchant for waxing poetic a little bit. And I think the book is at its strongest when he's sticking to the facts of the situation and talking about the process by which he investigated what happened and found information that had been kind of lost as far as the archive goes. And then it's kind of at its worst when he's inserting himself into the narrative by like really kind of sharpening his prose on the situation. So if you found anything that I just mentioned to be slightly interesting, give this book a shot. If you know someone in your life who is involved in fighting wildfires, ask them if they have read this book, and if they haven't, get the book for them, because I think that they would find it interesting. This book details, one of the guys who survived did so by implementing a technique that had never been done before officially by the Forest Service and is now like standard practice. Like he survived by essentially lighting a secondary fire in order to burn the ground in front of him so that when the fire caught up to him, it didn't burn the ground that he was standing on. It just kind of burned around it, which is something that was used by indigenous peoples for a long time. But according to the guy who implemented it, he'd never heard of any of that. He just kind of came up with it on the fly. Like I said, it was the first official time that it was ever used by a Forest Service wildland firefighter. And now that's kind of like a common practice technique that is taught to people of, if you're really up against a wall, this is a last-ditch effort to try. And so learning the history of that was interesting and could be interesting to someone in your life.
Yeah, that is interesting. I've never fought a forest fire, but...
But Sid, have you been doing or watching or reading anything lately that you would like to tell people about?
Not really, but I am about to start. I just chose what fiction book I'm going to start next. I actually haven't like read another fiction book since I read, other than Her Body and Other Parties, but I'm still working through the Harry Potter audiobooks, but I haven't read another fiction book since The House in the Cerulean Sea that I mentioned at the end of our last series. But I've decided I'm going to read my first Sally Rooney And I'm going to read Normal People because I feel like...
Hell yeah.
That's a good place to start.
It is.
So I haven't started it. I just, like, this was a decision I made like yesterday, but
it's really good. I like it a lot. I think that Intermezzo is a better book. Mm-hmm. I think that she's coming into herself as an author a lot more in Intermezzo.
Yeah.
But just based purely on popularity and the means by which it's constructed and everything, I think it's a great place to start. Mm-hmm. It's one of the books that lives up to the hype, or at least it lived up to the hype for me.
Have you watched the, is it a show?
I have not.
I think it's a show. Yeah, so I'm excited about that. I kind of didn't want to read Sally Rooney. I've heard nothing but good things about her as an author from you as well as other people in my life. I just know that she doesn't use quotation marks, and that style really bothers me. But I've been told that it makes sense when you're reading, that it's not as bad as you'd expect.
I don't even know if I necessarily noticed, because that is the means by which Cormac McCarthy writes. And Cormac McCarthy is, like, potentially my favorite author.
That always bothers me. Like, if a author chooses to do that, even if I love the writing, even if I enjoy the book, I feel like sometimes I'm just like, ugh, but why? It like annoys something, me, really.
Something to try then potentially would be the audiobook version.
Yeah, I'm going to read it. I think it's, I don't know. I have a physical, I'm sure it'll be fine. It's really just a personal annoyance. I don't know if it's just that I'm like a language arts truther or what's going on, if this is journalist in me, but like every time I read a book that doesn't use quotation marks, I'm always like a little annoyed. And so I wasn't like avoiding Sally Rooney. I feel like I was just putting it off because I've owned Normal People for a bit, and
I mean, you know, give it a shot. If not for me, then for the newly engaged Taylor Swift.
Yes, that's something that I could mention. You know, it's actually crazy. I'll just step on my Taylor Swift soapbox for a second, that this woman was in a 6-year relationship with a man who didn't want to marry her. She has multiple songs about this, of feeling not seen and not understood. She has a lyric, "I wouldn't marry me either, pathological people pleaser who only wanted you to see her." And wanting someone to take action and wanting something to fight for a relationship and show that they love her and be proud about that love. And that relationship ended. And then she dated this football boy for 2 years, and he wants to marry her and is very loud and proud about their love. Loud and proud. Straight white people. anyways, I think that's very beautiful, and I hope they're happy. So, big news. So, yeah, let's get into our last two stories from Her Body and Other Parties. Yeah.
On the topic of relationships.
So the first story I'll do a quick summary of is Mothers. This one, the first time I ever read this book, which I've read it twice now, I actually, like, was one of the stories I felt a little stupid about because I think I was taking it too literally, and I had to go back and read it again. So I feel like it's very abstract and therefore can be a bit difficult to understand if you're trying to take it literally. But also it's speculative fiction, all of this. And so I think that you can kind of take things as you want. And so anyways, but the plot, loosely, of this story is that there's a woman, the narrator, who is kind of reeling, grieving, and attempting to recover from an abusive relationship with her ex-girlfriend. The ex-girlfriend is referred to as Bad, capital B. That's, I guess, it's not her name, but that's, you know, what we're calling her, Bad. And basically, she has this, you could take it literally, but hallucination, that Bad shows up at her house and leaves her with a child that they conceived together. These two women conceived, and Bad says, "This is your child. I gave birth to her. Now it's yours. Once again, I think let's keep in mind that this is a hallucination. But anyways, she is taking care of this child, trying to figure out what the child needs, eventually realizes the child is a girl and it's their daughter, and gives it a name. So Mara, the child's name is Mara. And Mara basically cries when she's not being held. Like, she cries constantly. And so the only time that Mara isn't crying is when this narrator is holding her. But she can't always be holding Mara. And so sometimes she has to put Mara down and she has to kind of coax her to sleep. And so sometimes, like, when Mara's sleeping, she gets a bit of a break from the crying. And then it kind of moves into the narrator traveling with the child, and they get on a bus, a train. I can't remember if it's a bus or a train. It's not really important. But they use public transit to travel somewhere. And they get there, and it's this, like, house in the woods. But let's backtrack. All throughout this time, like, as she's holding this child, as she's holding Mara, she's reflecting on her relationship with Bad. And so its beginnings, its successes, how happy she was early on, their sex life. But then we're starting to learn that it goes a little bit south, and Bad was abusive and verbally abusive and emotionally abusive and controlling. And so it's kind of like intertwined with, like, taking care of this child and reflecting on the relationship. But then we realize, like, as she arrives at this house in the woods, which is actually a chapel, it's like an old chapel, but that's been turned into a home, she's, like, hallucinating a life that she and Bad built together, where they live in this home and they have a dog and they have Mara, and turns out they have a son too. And then it kind of ends a little bit open-ended, but to me, it seems as though it ends with her, like, acknowledging that she's letting go that life at that house that's not actually real. So that's what I would say, basically, to summarize the story. Do you have any notes?
I think that it's also worth noting that the ending of the book, or the ending of the story, involves a different man and woman entering the house, mm-hmm. who then react very negatively to her being there. And it is essentially implied that Mara is a child that the narrator has, like, pseudo kidnapped or is, like, holding on to, and now she's broken into these people's house. Like, it's somewhat unclear as to exactly what's gone down, but I think the implication is supposed to be that this fairy tale life that she had dreamed of for herself is belonging to someone else, mm-hmm. and she is trespassing by being here.
I don't think Mara's real. That might be open to interpretation. But personally, I don't think that child ever existed. But
the woman tells Mara to stay away. The man clutches baby Tristan across his chest. And so, like, I think that the man and the woman are as, like, all of it is figurative, but the man and the woman are as real as Mara is.
Yeah. We'll get into the analysis of it later, but basically, yeah. I feel like that's kind of the rundown. And I said this in our first episode, but I definitely think that, like, if you're at all interested in these episodes, you should read the stories for yourself, because they're very, I would say, open to interpretation at times. Like, you take out of it what you want, in a way.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing my best here, but I, like, think that someone else might read that story and get something totally different than I did. And so
I think it's both, you take out of the stories what you want, but also you can take out of them what you bring to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you have specific life experiences, you're going to come away with different answers about this book than someone who has lived differently than you have.
Yeah. Okay. And then the last story in the book, and also the last one we're going to discuss, is Difficult at Parties. And this is probably my favorite one, actually. But
okay,
I don't know. It's like a, it's between that and probably The Husband Stitch, but I don't know. I do really love Difficult at Parties. So this story is also a little, it's more straightforward, but a little unclear at times. It's following a narrator. And in every single story we've discussed, the narrator's been unnamed. So the narrator is unnamed, but it's a woman who is recovering from a seemingly intense sexual trauma. It doesn't really make clear exactly what the trauma is, but it's some sort of sexual assault and or rape.
Yeah. Over the course of the story, it has her partner referring to maybe she would like to move somewhere else. And so, like, I think that it's implied that her home was broken into by someone and then she was assaulted.
Yeah. It begins with her leaving the hospital. Her partner, Paul, has picked her up from the hospital. And so we know that she had gone there because of this assault, because of this violence. And we know that the police questioned her at the hospital. And they're trying to find the perpetrator, but throughout the story, it really never comes back to them figuring out who this person was. So the narrator is kind of trying to recover, but has become very detached from reality and is basically just a shell of her former self. Like, she has just really retreated into herself and she's not the same anymore after this trauma. Paul, her partner, is supportive and gentle and trying to help her. And so at like one point he encourages her, like, how about you get out of the house? Let's go to this housewarming party of my friends. And so they do go to the party. It's two women, I guess, I don't know if they're married or partners, but two women who are partners have just purchased a home and they go to this party. And this is where the story gets its name, because the narrator is difficult at this party in a sense. I wanted to read a little bit of it. She says, friendly people I've never met ask me about my job, about my life. They reach across me for wine glasses, touch my arm. Each time I move away, not directly back, but a half step to the right, and they match my movements. And in this way, we move in a small circle as we speak. The last book I read, I repeat slowly, but I can't remember. I remember the satiny cover beneath the pads of my fingertips, but not the title or the author or any of the words inside. I think I'm talking funny with my burned mouth, my numb tongue fat and useless inside my mouth. I want to say, don't bother asking me anything. I want to say, there's nothing underneath. And so just throughout the whole party, she's really struggling to socialize and really struggling to just feel anything, feel real in her body, feel present. She gets really drunk. She gets her finger scratched by the cat, and she's just having a bad time at this party. And eventually she leaves and just goes out to the car. And then when Paul gets out to the car, she throws up everywhere. At the same time, you know, Paul is kind of, you know, as Samuel mentioned, encouraging her, what if you moved? What if you get out? But he's also just trying to encourage her to cope in some way. And also, their relationship has changed as a result of this trauma, and they're touching a little bit, but not a lot, and they're not having sex anymore. And so to kind of attempt to reconnect romantically and sexually, but also to help her deal with the trauma, she begins watching porn, and she specifically orders porn offline, like tapes that are sent to her that are for couples. And she's kind of not obsessively watching it, but starts watching it a lot, but it's not having like an arousing effect for her. Really what's happening is she starts hearing voices over the soundtracks. So not like what they're actually saying to each other, but hearing something else. And she discovers that these voices are actually the thoughts of the people in the pornographic videos. Like, what are they thinking while they're engaging in sexual activities? And she's not sleeping well. She's kind of like flailing around in her sleep and being violent and screaming, and nothing is getting really better. And Paul, he's really trying, but you can also see that like he still misses their sex and he misses their desire. And he's like, remember how much you used to want me. And she says, I cannot remember ever being thirsty. And basically the story ends and she hasn't really gotten better, but she and Paul do finally have sex. And she's starting, it's like a first step towards some sort of recovery, but it's very much on her own terms. And she films it and watches it back. And that's kind of most of the things I wanted to discuss. Is there anything you thought was important for the summary?
Yeah, you kind of touched on it at the end, but it's worth noting that while she's at the party, there's a guy who is being obnoxious with a video camera who's recording the party, and whenever she leaves the party, she steals that video camera. And the ending portion of that story is her first setting up the camera in order to watch herself sleep, and then later setting up the camera to record her and Paul having sex. And then the movie ends, or the story ends with her beginning to watch that tape of them having sex, with the implication being that by doing this, maybe just like the porn she was watching, she'll be able to hear her own thoughts and know what it is that's going on in her head.
Yeah. So I chose these two stories not because they have the same like topic, but because they're both women dealing with trauma and how do you recover from those traumas? And I thought that was an interesting way to tie them together.
Mm-hmm.
But before we kind of do an analysis and what we thought of the stories, I wanted to briefly touch on something that might have kind of inspired is maybe not the right word, but another book by Carmen Maria Machado that talks about her own experience with domestic violence and abuse specifically. If you want to know more about Carmen Maria Machado, in part one of this series, I told some more fun facts about her. But specifically right now, I wanted to talk about In the Dream House, which is her memoir detailing her life, but through the lens of an abusive relationship she was in with someone who she calls the woman in the dream house. So this person's never named, but it's an ex-partner. And we basically see her story before, during, and after this relationship, which was emotionally, verbally, psychologically, and even physically abusive. And throughout the book, she also kind of just educates readers on the history of domestic violence, and more specifically, like, talking about the lack of domestic violence stories that involve queer relationships. And she also critiques the portrayal of queer characters in the media, and it's really, the book is doing a lot. But what I wanted to, there's a couple things I wanted to highlight from it. One is, there's some quotes at the beginning, you know how books sometimes, is that called like the epigraph?
The epigraph?
Yeah, there's like three different quotes at the beginning, which speak a little bit to why she wrote this, and then I think speak to why she writes, or at least wrote also Her Body and Other Parties. So, says, if you are silent about your pain, they'll kill you and say you enjoyed it. Your mind, indeed, is tired. Your mind so tired that it can no longer work at all. You do not think, you dream. Dream all day long, dream everything, dream maliciously and incessantly. Don't you know that by now? And then, in the prologue of In the Dream House, it's a really good prologue, and I wish we had time for me to read the whole thing to you, but she mentions an essay by Sadia, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, Hartman, called Venus and Two Acts. And it's about, this essay is about contemporaneous African accounts of slavery. But this essay talks about the violence of the archive, or the concept archival silence, which is how, you know, sometimes stories are destroyed and sometimes they're never uttered in the first place. Either way, something very large is irrevocably missing from our collective histories. And then she kind of discusses the word archive more, its etymology. And in its etymology, it comes from an ancient Greek word that means the house of the ruler. And she says she was really taken with the use of the word house because she's a lover of haunted house stories and she loves architecture metaphors. But she goes on to say what is placed in or left out of the archive is a political act dictated by the archivist and the political context in which she lives. This is true whether it's a parent deciding what's worth recording of a child's early life or a continent publicly reckoning with its past. And she goes on to say that this memoir at its core was an act of, resurrection. Memoirists recreate the past, reconstruct dialogue. They summon meaning from events that have long been dormant. They braid the clays of memory and essay in fact and perception together, smash them into a ball, roll them flat. They manipulate time, resuscitate the dead. They put themselves and others into necessary context. So she wanted to enter into the archive that domestic abuse between partners who share a gender identity is both possible and not uncommon. We can look at something like this. And so basically the whole prologue, and that was so, like, that was such an abridged version, because she also discusses, like, the abused woman has been around for a long time and I know that this exists and I know these stories exist, but we should be talking more about them because, and what she says and the dedication is, if you need this book, this is for you. And so I think this is, with all this context, I'm trying to weave a lot of things together here. Machado herself has clearly, we talked about this in the first part, experienced being a non-white woman. She's experienced being, she describes herself as a fat woman. She has experienced things, and her own experience of womanhood is hers. And she's also experienced an abusive relationship, and she's written an entire memoir about it. And I think that she's written about all of this across two books to not add something new, but to enter a story into the archive, enter stories into the archive that provide representation. And I'm getting into analysis here, but I guess I'll just jump into analysis from here. Something that you mentioned in part one, which I like totally understand and like thought was like an interesting and valid critique, is that like this book listens more than it speaks. But I think that was like the point. And I think that especially these two stories illustrate that. and then if we take that and we put that with the context of her memoir and the, if you need this book, it's for you, like these stories and that book are here so that women and queer women and non-white women and both able-bodied and not able-bodied women and women of all sizes and women of all experiences feel heard and feel seen. And they can see that through this like articulate creative expression of the pain that you just like feel in your body as a woman. And to see a representation of who you are moving through this world. And no one can take that away from you. And so I think that, like, that's what I like specifically about Difficult at Parties. But anyways, I, like, really jumped the gun on, like, where I was going with that. I just started talking. But yeah. what did you take away before I just keep rambling? What did you take away from these two stories? And, like, knowing the context of also that she herself has experienced abuse. And
I, of the two, liked Difficult at Parties more. Mm-hmm. I thought that it was a interesting look and an interesting take on the story that she's telling. And I thought that the concept of, like, the way in which it relates the experience of becoming very much internalized in your experience following sexual assault was very interesting. Like, the way in which not only is she having a tough time interacting with other people, but the internality has gone so far that she's hearing the thoughts of people who are having sex and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it was a really interesting examination of what does sex look like after sexual violence. Of like, I think you can take it very literally, difficult at parties, she is having a tough time relating to other people. But I think that the more interesting interpretation that is also being hinted at is the party of having sex with someone that you care about and the ways in which that has been made difficult following a traumatic event. And so I thought that that was, like I said, it was interesting. I enjoyed reading that story and kind of seeing those metaphors at play and seeing that kind of internal struggle being made more manifest.
Hmm. Something that I liked is that both of these stories, you know, they're both looking at like the disintegration of life after a trauma. So for one, it's domestic violence or abuse, and for the other person, it's sexual violence. But abuse is in some sense, they're both, their lives have fallen apart and their internal, like who they are internally, has fallen apart. And both stories, more than the other stories in this book, have this kind of like hallucinogenic, dreamy quality. Like you're a little confused. Mm-hmm. Like you don't really know what's going on, what's real and what isn't. And I like that. I think that's a good device to represent like what life feels like and what your brain feels like and what your body feels like after experiencing intense trauma. You know, what's real and what isn't, and how do I move forward? And I thought that was really interesting. And then in Mothers, for me, and this is something I was saying, let's come back to this. I thought that like Mara, the child, was like a representation of the relationship itself. And basically, when you're in an abusive relationship, even if you recognize that it's abusive, even if the baby's screaming constantly, you still have love and affection for that person, for the abuser. And so there's a part where the narrator is looking at the baby and says, "The open howling mouth, that's all bad." And then says, "I stop the danger of this joke still firing in my brain, even as I realize that bad isn't here to hear it. To pause whatever she is doing, to raise an eyebrow at me, maybe scold me for saying such a thing in front of our daughter, or maybe throw a glass at my head." And then says she pulls out her phone and she calls bad, and bad doesn't answer, and she leaves a message. This is what I say. Why did you leave her with me? What I want to say. This almost broke me, but it didn't, and made me stronger than before. You have made me better. Thank you. I will love you forever until the end of time. And then she goes on to like feel similarly about the baby, like is so overwhelmed by the crying and the, I can't be a mother. I don't know how to do this. But then when she gets like a break, when there's a moment of quietness, she's like, I can do it now. And she says like, I can endure it because of that precious moment, that break. But it's like, I feel like the baby is like a metaphor for trying to get over this relationship and for the relationship and for the abuser herself. Like,
yeah,
the howling, the crying, it's filling the room, it's surrounding her. And it's so interesting because it's like, even though your abuser is your abuser, like there's a reason people stay with their abusers even after they're being abused. And part of it is manipulation and maybe fear and feeling stuck. But then part of it is because a lot of times people feel love for that person still. And I think it's interesting to use like a baby.
Yeah. I think that I interpreted it slightly different than you, but very similarly, where mm-hmm. for me, the baby, as is typically the case with a baby, is like the evidence of a relationship having happened. Mm-hmm. And she's stuck holding the bag, as it were, of now being outside of this relationship, but still in a way that her ex-partner is not, being forced to bear the responsibility of what's left after the relationship has ended. And I think that it's a little bit on the nose of, like, the baby's name is Mara, and traditionally, like, the interpretation of Mara as a name means bitter. Like, that's what this person is kind of feeling as a result of this relationship ending, and trying to grapple with both the understanding that the relationship was a negative in some ways, while still accounting for the fact that the relationship brought some degree of joy and connection to their life.
Another, like, thread that I thought kind of tied these stories together a little bit was the idea of, like, how do you deal with the fact that trauma has robbed you of what you're expected to be or what you expected to be? And so I guess, like, what I mean by that is, like, in Mothers, she expected this domestic life. Like, she was going to be a mother. She was going to be a wife. And obviously it's, like, not nuclear family cookie cutter. It's with a woman. But still, I mean, she had this whole, like, expectation for her life, and the trauma and the abuse that she endured has, like, now robbed that from her. She doesn't have that anymore. And so now, like, how do you cope? How do you move forward? And for Difficult at Parties, she's been robbed of, like, a sex life, and not really, but, like, for the time being, I think that, you know, that's, she's watching the porn, and that's been taken from her, being, like, a sexual object, which is, like, kind of what women can be made out to be, has been taken from her. And that's been taken from her in her relationship. That's been taken from her in life. Like, she's not getting, like, arousal from this porn anymore. And so that's been taken. And who are you now that you're not someone who enjoys sex? And it doesn't mean she never will, but, like, right now, that's not what's happening for her. And I liked that both characters were unraveling that, but at the same time, I liked that there wasn't really a strong resolution in the end for either. Like, I liked that there was maybe something that was a step towards acceptance, maybe, and which could be the first step towards, like, recovery, but it wasn't really, like, they're okay now. Because, like, you can't take that away for the rest of your life. You've endured that trauma at the hands of another person, that violence. And you might be changed forever. And the reader is forced to reckon with the fact that these women, alone in their minds, that trauma is forever there, and you have to see them. Mm-hmm. You have to see them as they are, and you have to see them as broken. And in that, you might see that you're not alone. And that's kind of what I was getting at earlier about. Yeah. Like, so I like that.
Yeah. So, like, I guess a criticism that I would levy, and this is going in the same bucket as anything else that I've said before, where it's, I think that the themes and the stories of this book, like you were talking about, with this being a collection of stories that are being told so that women have their stories in the archive, in the literary canon. As a result of that, if you read these stories and you get something out of them, then it has done what it is intended to do, and it is an effective form of storytelling. And so I'm not saying that there's no way in which this is completely ineffective, that it is totally devoid of value or anything like that. It's just the things that I think are limiting it from having potential value beyond the specific target audience, I guess. And so my criticism for Mothers is, I think it feels very sophomoric, almost, of the baby's name is bitter and the ex's name is bad. and the baby's hard to deal with, and then at the end of it all, you realize that the fantasy that you had come up with for your relationship is one that was intended for someone else all along, and it was never yours to stake a claim in. And Machado is a relatively new writer as far as, like, published works, and so I'm not, like, saying that this is going to forever be a mark on her reputation, but I think that as far as these stories go, this one feels the most like someone who is early in their career, where it's being overly heavy-handed with its metaphor of what it's saying. And so, like, I definitely understand, like, if that is a experience that you've lived through, you could very easily read it and take away something. You're like, ah, this speaks to my experience and provides value to me. But I think as someone who's speaking outside of that experience, it provides very little for me beyond telling someone else's story. And so I read it and I say, well, yeah, it sucks to be in an abusive relationship. Like, it's not putting words to an emotion that I have felt but couldn't identify within myself. It's just kind of stating what was somewhat obvious already. Like, it has the vibe to me of reading a nonfiction book about a topic that you're already familiar with, where you can kind of get something out of the storytelling devices, but as far as, like, the meat of it, it's not necessarily revelatory for you. And so with this specific book, and then I, like, this specific story, and then I think kind of expanding into the book as a whole, I feel as though I don't always love her writing style. And so because of that, the storytelling elements don't hook me very much. And then the messages and stories that it's trying to communicate are focused on relaying experiences instead of, like, making a statement. And so it makes it a lot more difficult for me to, like, really connect with the book when the message of the story is eating disorder is bad. It's not good to abuse women. It abusive relationships suck. Like, not really at times delving much deeper than that, I feel like, makes it to where I find myself at arm's length from the book for a lot more of it than I would have liked to have been.
Yeah. I feel like I've already kind of, like, dove into why I like it. So I guess I'll, and I recognize that it has, like, debut author vibes at times. So, like,
because it's essentially a debut author.
Yeah. And this was her first book. So
yeah. Yeah. I mean, all of the works had previously been published, so it's not, like, technically the debut, but, like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think, as I already mentioned, like, to see a representation of you and your body and your experiences, and to see your sisters, your mothers, your friends, your family, to see that portrayed in, like, what I find to be very, like, creative and often beautiful prose. Just, like, that's, like, not a feeling that every book gives me, but I also see that I'm the target audience. So, like, and she's not, like, demanding much of you as a reader. She's just saying that, like, I see you, and I've been there too, in these, like, just most terrible, intimate, awful moments and experiences. Don't be alone in that complete darkness that's surrounding you. Don't retreat inward, because I see you and now you see me, and we're here, we're in this together. Yeah. And I think that's worthwhile. I think that's important. I think that's, that was definitely a word that I, worthwhile, I just, I want to say, in case anyone tries to say plagiarism, I read this review of of the book from Nicole Flattery in the White Review, and she said, I was going to read this and I forgot, but I wrote it because she said these are stories that listen more than they speak, and I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. And then she was like, it may be naive, blah, 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 but I believe this to be absolutely worthwhile. And I was like, yeah, I think that it is absolutely worthwhile. And I like the speculative fiction style. I like weaving it with other genres. But that's that. So
definitely. And then I think the last thing that I was going to say on the book as a whole is something that we've just kind of like quite literally talked around in the book, and that is that like a third of the book is made up of a story called Especially Heinous that is maybe the main reason I don't like the book as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
It really falls flat for me. This one is one that is, it takes several seasons worth of Law and Order SVU episode titles and then uses the title as a prompt to do a quick fictionalized synopsis of what that episode could have been about, and as a result essentially does a rewrite of Law and Order SVU where it's going like episode by episode of like, this is what the story could have been that was told, but instead it was something different, and it crafts a narrative of a different landscape within which SVU could have taken. And it just had very strong college writing course prompt vibes to me of like, it felt like such a crutch to use, where I think that she had a story to tell and had an interesting story, and to then frame it in the way that she did, it very much didn't do anything for me. And it is like a third of the book.
Yeah, that is my least favorite story. And I will say that like, the first time I read this, I also came out of it being like, why is this the longest story? And I read some like reviews and interviews she did, and I respect it. I don't, it also is not one that I like particularly like, but I feel like I got like some fresh perspective from reading more about it, but I also was like, meh. I still didn't want to like particularly call it out to talk about. I will say though, for the game that we're about to play, the Reading Your Reviews game, one of the reviews that I chose not to use because we didn't talk about the story, but was a 2-star review that said, just can't look past Law and Order fan fiction. I was like, it does read like fan fiction.
Yeah.
So that's funny. But yeah, so before we read your reviews, let's go last one more time through the 5 bookmarks of satire for these 2 stories, starting with, oh, and if this is the first episode you're listening to, I always almost forget to say, like, what is that? But it's just 5 markers of satire that we use to gauge how satirical is this book, or in this case, are these stories. And the first one is humor. No, none of these.
There's a little bit of humor, I think, in Difficult at Parties, but it's not a humorous story, really.
And then we have exaggeration, and I would say it's less exaggeration, more just like unrealistic, like, you know, it's like things that are not
Difficult
real.
At Parties is exaggerating
by
like, you see other people having sex and you are able to hear their thoughts and stuff. Like, I think that that is some exaggeration, but yeah, I think that it's tough to say that there is exaggeration when the method of storytelling is supposed to be so introspective.
Yeah.
Because you're not really exaggerating an external experience, you're relating an internal experience, which is inherently an exaggeration of life.
Yeah, and it's also that there's like this supernatural element in a lot of these stories, and so like obviously that's not real and exaggerated, but also it's like just a style choice rather than a like exaggeration. Irony, maybe a little in Difficult at Parties.
I think that there's some irony in Mothers. I think that it's pretty tongue-in-cheek to just call the ex bad and call the baby bitter. Like, I think that it's a little bit ironic. I would give, at the very least, I think I would give them that point.
Okay. And then ridicule, I don't, maybe a little bit in Difficult at Parties with like the porn.
Yeah, it's tough because I think that all of the things that you have said about the purposes of the story inherently make it to where she can't ridicule. Because it's like if you're trying to be an accepting mirror by which people can see their stories and relate to their stories, then if you're ridiculing your main characters, you're ridiculing your audience, which doesn't really track. So I think that she's very sympathetic towards the situations of her characters, which makes me think like there's not really any ridicule.
But there is, as with all of them, critique. And so really both of these stories get like a 1.5, maybe 2 out of 5. They're not very satirical, either of them, I would say. And as a whole, this book is like loosely satirical, in my opinion. It's not.
Yeah, I think that you find the elements of it throughout, but there's like 2 or 3 stories that are very satirical, and then a lot of them that are more societal critiques, which at the end of the day, satire is a critique of society, but it's using very little in the way of the like bookmarks of satire that we lean on to say whether or not it's satirical.
And then let's do this game that we do where we just read some of your reviews of the books we read. I went with all 1-star reviews, even though I know I liked this a lot more than you did. I kind of went with some, I chose some of these reviews for specific reasons as well.
So the first one that I'm going to read is a 1-star review from Jill, who read this in 2017. A previous reviewer compared this book to abstract art. I would have to agree. Art critics often rant and rave over artwork that the layman sees and shakes their head in confusion. Whereas a single red stripe on a white canvas may be brilliant to some, to others, it is just pointless. With regards to this book, I am the layman. I place a lot of importance on a book's Goodreads rating, so I was eager to read this one. Upon finishing it, however, I am shaking my head in confusion and lack of understanding for the great ratings. Shaking my damn head. I found the stories pointless, tedious, and often silly. For example, the Law and Order, quote, story. It took me longer than normal to finish this book because there was nothing attracting me to return to it other than the obligation to finish it. This goes down with The Sentimentalists as one of the worst books I have ever dragged myself through. I think it's interesting that they say it took them longer than usual and it took them, according to their read dates, only 8 days to read it. Like, it's still it's still a pretty quick turnaround time. Yeah.
You know, it's just, the reason I chose this one is because it's always abstract art. People are always bringing up abstract art.
It pisses me off that this person, I believe, is specifically making reference to the artwork Who's Afraid of the Color Red? Which is maybe the best example of effective abstract art because it's just a huge canvas that's painted red that has at least 2 times had a member of the public go to it in a museum and shred it, like slice it from the canvas because it pissed them off so bad that this was considered art. Which is the point that you are so upset about the color red that your action to destroy this piece is in itself performance art. So like they're referencing not just one of the most famous pieces of abstract art, but they're maybe referencing the single most effective piece of abstract art, and they just completely missed the point of it.
Yeah, I just was like, oh, you always gotta bring abstract art into why you don't like a book, huh? Okay, so this review is from someone in 2023, and they said, "It's giving Tumblr. Derogatory." And I thought that was funny.
I think that there are times when I don't disagree with them, but it's a little bit harsh of a review.
Yeah. Derogatory.
I there have been times in my life when I, as a person, have been giving Tumblr derogatory.
Yeah, me too.
All right, my last one-star review is from Lori, also from 2017. I have no idea what this book is trying to get across. I think that's a you problem. I listened to the first two stories. The first one, Green Ribbon, was okay, but very predictable, like I had read it before. The second short story read like a jock bragging graphically about his sexual conquests. That's where I had to stop reading. I guess I just didn't get the point. I was really excited about this book, and the summary made it sound like cutting edge, but I just found it annoying. This goes on the, quote, "don't waste your time" shelf, which I'm a fan of them shelving it. They've got it shelved. If you have used Goodreads, you can put books on basically lists where you're categorizing your own books. And they're called shelves. And this person has shelved this book into the categories of read, didn't finish, and nope, waste of time.
The funniest part about this review to me was they were like, the first one, I feel like I've read it before.
Yeah, everyone has. It's like, a very common story.
That was
and then
the
it's
point.
Crazy to me to interpret the second story as a jock bragging about sexual conquests when it's just about like sexual violence and sexual, like it's a very surface level interpretation of a story based purely on the fact that it includes sex, and so it must therefore be simple-minded.
Yeah, Lori just definitely didn't get the point, which, I mean, they started the review by saying that, so I guess that's fine, but and then the last one is I love to find a good conservative review from someone in 2018, and they said, "It is not poignant, relevant, important. It's just an anthology of quirky stories that make no sense at all. Everything is just plain weird, but not weird in a fascinating sort of way. Weird and strange in a, ooh, I'm so quirky and different. I'm a snowflake sort of style. This was just bad and ridiculous. I do not DNF, as in almost never, but there was no point in continuing something that was going nowhere. I do not recommend," all caps. This story is weird and strange in a I'm so quirky and different, I'm a snowflake kind of way.
That's an interesting perspective, you know?
I just don't think anyone uses the word snowflake if they are not conservative, but I also just don't understand how a more conservative-minded person found this book, read the back of it, and said, "I want to read that."
I mean, I think if you are a woman, I think that the back of the book does kind of hint towards a collectivism that maybe even if you're conservative, you'll think, well, because I'm a woman, this is something I will enjoy and relate to, which could be entirely true. Not every victim of sexual violence is a liberal.
Yeah, no, I mean, true.
But, yeah, I think that there, it's got to be a tough, it's got to be a tough world out there to be a reader who is conservative, because they really aren't making books for you, huh? Like, I feel like all you've got out there is straight romance books. And
you've
like,
got Colleen Hoover. She's always there for you.
Colleen Hoover and Malcolm Gladwell. They love you.
It's just that the fact does describe it as queer. And that's really the main thing. It says, earthy and otherworldly, antic and sexy, queer and caustic, comic and deadly serious. I don't know. And I just felt that didn't feel very
conservative. But I mean, who reads the back of books anymore? I feel like most people just get recommended books on TikTok and then they see the cover.
Ah, maybe. Yeah, that's true. Well, I read the back of books, so this is a PSA. And to close out, we've already kind of given you our thoughts on this book, so let's just do a quick, like, what was your star rating and see if we can come to some average.
Yeah, we're going to have to come to some sort of an average because it's come time for us to rank this book in our ever-expanding list of every satire book ever written. We've only done 5 so far, so we've got a top 5. For those who are new, the best book that we have read thus far is 1984, followed by Slapstick by Kurt Vonnegut, Lula Dean's Little Library of Banned Books by Kirsten Miller, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, and Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. So, I am not going to advocate that this is being put below Fahrenheit 451, and so this is going to be a shakeup of our top 5 in some way or another, but we are going to have to come to a consensus.
So
my opinion...
Go. Yeah.
I think that taking into consideration the effectiveness of relaying the experiences of others and the enjoyment that other people are likely to get out of this, while also balancing my personal enjoyment and my personal opinions related to the quality of some of the writing, I think this is a 3-star book. Like, it's right down the middle for me.
So I gave it 5 stars, but in keeping in mind our ranking as like a podcast and what it's all about, I don't think it's as strong of a satire as most of the books we've read.
Yeah.
And we're looking for like the best satirical novel, and so like I would in no way advocate for this going above 1984 or Slapstick. And I even think Lula Dean's Little Library of Banned Books is a better satire.
Yeah. I was gonna push for it to go in the number 4 slot of below Lula Dean but above Brave New World.
I can be okay with that, because I think I love it, but I totally see, like, in the grand scheme of our ranking, why it wouldn't be the top.
Yeah. And I also think that it suffers from being a collection of short stories,
mm-hmm.
where I feel like a full-length novel is... This is something that was mentioned in another book that I've read before, where it's people who are ranking and rating different books as part of a book award process, and they say, well, how are we comparing a collection of short stories where one story is bad versus a full-length novel that has some flaws? Like, how do those compare to one another? And like, in my personal preference, I feel like I prefer a full-length novel with occasional flaws over a short story collection where one of the stories just doesn't work.
Mm.
Yeah. Not to say that that's necessarily the case with this one, that that's why I'm rating it where I'm rating it, but I think that Lula Dean has some flaws as a story.
Mm-hmm.
This collection has some flaws as a collection.
Yeah.
But because it's a collection, I have a preference towards Lula Dean's flaws than to this's flaws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you heard it. 4th best satirical book we've read. And that bumps Fahrenheit 451 out of the top 5. Thank God.
Good riddance. Next up is Brave New World. We're gunning for you.
Well, that'll do it for Her Body and Other Parties. Thank you for listening, and bearing with us through this series. It's very different than what we've done before. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something out of it. We would love to hear more of your thoughts on this series. I specifically, I guess I'm speaking for myself, would love to hear what stories you enjoy, what stories you don't enjoy, your thoughts on the format of this. If we ever do a series of short stories again, did you like this format? You know, let us know your thoughts. So if you want to do that, you can find us on Instagram at the Satire Fire Pod, P-O-D. And also we can be found on TikTok, Blue Sky, and YouTube at The Satire Fire.
Yeah. And like Sid said, that's where we can be found. Super cool. Be sure to rate us 5 stars. Leave a comment. Tell your friends about us because we really appreciate it. If you are looking for a way to support the podcast, we don't talk about it very often, but in the show notes, we always have a link to a bookshop page that is an affiliate link for us, and there's going to be some lists on there, both of every book that we've talked about on the podcast so far, as well as lists of mine and Sydney's favorites. And if you choose to buy a book from there, you support the podcast a little bit, and you also avoid supporting Jeff Bezos and Amazon, which is always the goal. But the intro and outro of the podcast are remixes of the song 48 by Kulla. If you join us next week, we are going to have Sydney lead us through a interlude episode just to give a little bit more time for us to read and prepare for the next series, as well as you to read and prepare should you choose to. Because since we have not quite gotten enough content about violence against women yet, our next series is going to be on American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. It's going to be coming out like late September, early October-ish as a series, and so it's kind of like a Halloween special for us. So be on the lookout for that. As a heads up, it can be tough to read at times, so if you choose not to read it, totally understandable, but I'm going to read it for you and tell you all about it.
Yeah, so looking forward to seeing you again next week for our interlude on something. Nope. But I still haven't decided on. Maybe we just don't mention. We'll just say interlude. Everyone will be surprised. You can cut this part out or not, and I'll just sound stupid. Thank you for listening today. We'll see you next week. This is the Satire Fire. I'm Sydney.
And I'm Samuel.
Bye.
Bye.
I've just about come to the end of the road. Here, I've just about lost patience with you people. You get your ass out into the mountains or someplace or hide in there and watch that damn tube. But if not, fuck it. I'm done. In fact, my sermon